I guess so. I'm just eating a cookie, and I'll be done in 2 seconds.
Oh, no problem. Is it chocolate chip?
Is there any other kind?
You know, I interviewed Famous Amos one time, and I thought his favorite cookie would have been the chocolate chip, but he likes
it. He invented.
Yeah, he likes macadamia nut. Who knew?
The big finale.
Welcome back to the big finale. This is episode 4 tonight. We will be discussing the book, The Aztec UFO Incident, with one of the co-authors, Frank Thayer, later in the hour. Now, next week, what we plan to do is we plan to bring back the Ayatollah of Radiola, Chad Miles, and the gregarious one, Gabe Reed. They're not with us this week. We have a guest. But next week, Chad Miles and Gabe Reed will return to talk about this week's interview in a roundtable discussion. We'll talk about some other stuff, too. Now, I also want to let you know, as if you didn't know this, that in addition to doing the big finale, we also do a program called The Bruce Collins Show, which airs on WWPR, 1490 AM, and also at ipbn-fm.com. If you don't listen to The Bruce Collins Show, my question is, why not? Up next, our guest is Frank Thayer, and he's been investigating a strange event that is chronicled in the new book, The Aztec UFO Incident, right here on The Big Finale. And I have a great page-turning book here that I know you're going to be interested in. The title is The Aztec UFO Incident, The Case, Evidence, and Elaborate Cover-Up of One of the Most Perplexing Crashes in History. And this is a real brow-raising book here, co-written with Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer. And Frank Thayer is joining us this week. Frank Thayer is a PhD and also a New Mexico native with extensive journalistic and journalism education experience. Now a professor emeritus at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, he has professional experience as a writer, editor, photographer, and educator. Joining Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, as I said before, he has co-authored the new book, The Aztec UFO Incident, and I recommend you get a copy of this book. It is really something else, and I wasn't aware of, actually, this incident, so for me it was doubly interesting. Tons of documentation, a whole lot of pictures, and a lot of great information between the covers of this book. Frank Thayer, welcome to The Bruce Collins Show.
Glad to be here, Bruce. I got lots to talk about, and I know you have some questions to ask.
Yeah, now this is a fascinating book, but before we delve into the specifics of this book, The Aztec UFO Incident, can you tell us how you became involved with this story?
You know, it's I go back to my post-college days when I was a reporter, and right here in Las Cruces, New Mexico, by the way, And New Mexico had a number of sightings in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. And I, as part of a feature series that I did a couple of stories about local people who'd seen UFOs. I'd never seen one. And I sort of got interested in it as a concept, and I let it ride. I went on to, I got my military experience. I went to Canada to live and teach, and I always thought that there was something to it, but I never heard anything. Remember, Roswell didn't even register on the Richter scale. It was a one-day story. It disappeared. It was not a real deal until 1980. Aztec should have been famous, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And when I came back to New Mexico in 1977, it was about 3 years later that the Roswell incident came out. I bought the book and said, there it is. All you need to prove is one case to show that UFOs, there is some reality to them. And from then on, I was a Roswell scholar, you might say. I read every reliable thing I could get on it. And along about 2009, no, actually, it was 2006, that I found a book by a fellow named William Steinman, UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret. It was so well-kept, I had never heard of his book. And I found it on, I think I found it on eBay. And I read the book and said, he makes a good case that there was really something other than Roswell. And I put it on my website. I have my website, www.frankthayer.net. And I did an essay on the possible reality of the Aztec incident. 2009, I got an email from a fellow named Scott Ramsey. He said, hey, Frank, and he says, that's what he says when he calls me. He said that I've been working on this thing since 1986, and I think it's a real deal. We're trying to write a book on it, and how would you like to join the team? And I didn't hesitate, even a half a breath. There I was. And we worked on the first book from 2009 to 2012 and put out this privately published, called it The Aztec Incident, Recovery at Hart Canyon. It was privately published, not many copies, 1,000 copies or so. And all of a sudden, a year later, New Page, Career Press, New Page Books, asked if we wanted to do a book for them, widely published and distributed. And we said, yeah, we think we could, because we had new material. So in December 15th, 2015, we published The Aztec UFO Incident. And you're reading it. You understand that it's a dynamite book. We wanted to write the best flying saucer book ever written, in the sense that it's factual, it's irrefutable, and anybody who reads it's going to come away saying, yes, this really happened. Mm-hmm. That brings us up to date.
So you and I and our listener are going to sneak into Area 51 right now, and we're going to get in a time machine and go back to March 25th, 1948. What happened on that day?
Before dawn, March 25th, a couple of policemen were riding in northwestern New Mexico on a lonely two-lane highway, and they'd seen strange objects. They saw this glowing object going over their patrol car headed to the northwest. And they decided to follow it because it looked like it was wobbling. About 5:30 in the morning, a rancher, he was coming out to take care of his goats before dawn, and he saw this craft coming over his property and turning north, and it ran right into a cliff just opposite his property. But it showered sparks, but it raised up and it kept going. And that sounded strange to him. And he went to find a telephone, and that's pretty hard to find in New Mexico in 1948. And he called Albuquerque, Kirtland Air Force Base, to get the Air Force. Say, guess what I saw? And they said, tell us what you saw. Thank you very much. Goodbye. We'll be in touch. And, of course, they never were. So this thing is going north from this rancher's place, and it lands. It lands on a mesa. It didn't crash. It settled on the mesa in a controlled landing. And it would have stayed there waiting for the military if it hadn't been for some oil field workers. These are 18, 19-year-old guys, and you and I remember when we were 18 and 19 years old. Anything we could do to make a living. And they were working as roughnecks in the oil field. And the oil company sent them out not because of the flying saucer, but because they heard that there was a fire out on the mesa. And so these guys went out there, and they stopped, and there was oil drip tanks at the bottom of the mesa. They wanted to make sure they were safe. The oil was safe. They walked up on this mesa, and I've walked up there too. And there was a 100-foot diameter aluminum disc lying there, just slightly tilted over, maybe 5-10 degrees, had a dome on top and a dome on the bottom. Now, you and I might have been, have common sense and be scared of it. These guys start walking around, hey, what's this? One of them got up and walked around on this flying saucer, and he saw circular lines on the dome, and it turned out to be portholes. He got up real close, and he said one of them had a hole in it the size of a quarter, and he got close, and he saw that the portholes were like mirrored sunglasses, except mirrored sunglasses hadn't been invented. He looked in, and he saw two bodies slumped over a console. And I think that that was the beginning. The sun was coming up. This is almost like a horror movie.
Yeah.
And they hung around, and about 16 people arrived on the mesa, ranchers, other oil field workers, and there was a preacher. We could talk about that sometime as well. And the cops. Remember those cops that were following the disc?
Mm-hmm.
These cops ended up on the mesa as well. And they were there milling around, looking at this thing, wondering about it before the military arrived. Now, the story gets complex here. Remember the hole in the porthole? Now, we don't know whether it was the military or the oil field workers who got a long pole, but probably the oil field workers had something like that in their truck, and stuck it through this whole quarter-sized hole and began poking around inside the cabin. And they hit a couple of buttons. Now, Bruce, you and I saw The Day the Earth Stood Still, right?
Right.
And that's what happened. This thing looked like it was seamless. No bolts, no rivets, no nothing. And all of a sudden, when they hit those buttons, the saucer opened up, just like in that movie.
Hmm.
Now, if that didn't scare you, nothing would. But that's when he said he saw the two bodies for sure lying dead, obviously dead, leaning over the console. And after a while, the military arrived. Now, one of our witnesses, there were two witnesses interviewed by Scott Ramsey. One of them said he didn't know what was stranger to him, the disc or what he saw next. That was an Army helicopter flying over the mesa. He had never seen a helicopter before, and of course they were brand new in the inventory of the new Air Force. And then the military arrived, and they took over. They separated everybody, debriefed them, and told them they could never speak of this because it was national security. And they began hauling bodies out. There were about anywhere from 14 to 16 bodies, depending on the source you ask. Now, Roswell didn't have that kind of clarity, but this one was 100%. Bodies came out, the saucer was undamaged, and the military said, you keep your mouth shut, and you'll get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go from here?
Well, one of the folks you mentioned, I would love you to elaborate on, was the preacher. What was his part in this?
Solon Brown, a Baptist preacher. He had a new church in Mancos, Colorado, which is about 30 miles north of the New Mexico border. And Aztec is almost right on the border. But he had a missionary goal. He had to go around the area ministering to people. He did some teaching of Navajo children in Arizona, which is right there at Four Corners area. And he saw a bunch of traffic headed down the dirt road that leads to the Heart Canyon area.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm going to go down there. I think there may have been an accident. I can help. He walked up on the mesa, and he saw what these other people saw. And then he was debriefed like everybody else, and he left, and he drove back to Colorado. That evening, he called his deacon in Mancos, Colorado, and the deacon brought his son, and they sat down with the preacher. He says, I have to tell you this. I saw something that changed my whole view of the world. And the story was told to Scott Ramsey by the son of the deacon. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, I remember this so clearly because I never saw a grown man cry. And apparently this shattered the world view of this preacher because he saw those little men or creatures or whatever they were lined up outside the craft.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, your book talks about Frank Scully. Who was Frank Scully and what part does he play in this story?
Frank Scully was a famous guy. It shows how fame is fleeting, right?
Yeah.
But he was a columnist for Variety, and he did Hollywood news, essentially. But he knew an oil man, a millionaire named Silas Newton. And Silas Newton and he talked about these things, and Newton was a geophysicist. He wasn't just a millionaire. He was a college-educated geophysicist. And he knew several people who were working for Vannevar Bush in the defense establishment during the war. And they were the ones who were marshaled to do research on the Aztec craft. And they told him about it. They told Silas Newton. They told Frank Scully. And he said, what a story. And they said, don't worry about it, because within a couple of months, this is 1949, the government's going to tell everybody all about it. Oh, you... Yes, I know this, what fools these mortals be. And so he said, I'm going to write a book about this. And he did. And in 1950, things ramped up. And here's the way it started. Silas Newton, the oil man, was stationed in Denver, Colorado. And one of the scientists was asked to give a speech to a Science 101 class at the University of Denver. And that was in March 1950. And the scientists backed out because, and Frank Scully says this, and I think we quote it in the book, men who would tell their secret for nothing in 1949 would not tell it for $20 million in 1950. So, but Silas Newton knew the story they told him. And he got up on the stage at the University of Denver, and he, to all these freshman science students, he said, there is such a thing as a flying saucer. And you'd think that that would have brought the story out for the whole public to know. Except that when he was done, he was hustled off the stage, and the Air Force was in town shortly saying, I want to know where that guy is. What's his name? He was billed as Scientist X on the stage. Hmm. And what a story that is. Now, Silas Newton left, and Frank Scully wrote the story that was printed in 1950 September, and it was a bestseller in the United States. Can you believe that? 50,000 copies was his bestseller in 1950. Hmm. And when he brought this book out, you'd think that that ends the story. But he wrote in a very journalistic manner, breezy style, lots of tongue-in-cheek stuff, but the story was 100% straight. And you say, well, what happened? What happened was what always happens. There's a spoiler. Mm-hmm. The spoiler was named J.P. Kahn, C-A-H-N. Mr. Kahn was a freelance reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he heard about the story, and he tried to buy it from Scully before he published the book, because he wanted to make a name for himself at the San Francisco Chronicle. Scully wouldn't sell. And this fellow, who was born rich, by the way, never had to work a day in his life if he didn't want to. He was so angry that he said he was going to get him. He was going to destroy Scully. He was going to destroy Newton. And he set about to do that in the next couple of years. And he finally found a way to get Newton charged with a fraud crime in Denver, in the district court in Denver. But J.P. Kahn went to the FBI to see if he could get help in prosecuting Scully, Newton, his partner, Leo Gebauer, anybody, to get this get these guys because he couldn't have his story. Well, the trial was in 1953, and before that, J.P. Kahn wrote a famous article. So the Flying Saucers and the Mysterious Little Men in True, the men's magazine. Most people don't remember that magazine, but those were in the days before Playboy. And when men were supposed to be reading about bear hunts and firearms and sword battles. And I think that article, and I've read it, showed me that Kahn was an excellent writer. He was an excellent writer, but he had a vendetta. He didn't write about flying saucers. He didn't write about Aztec. He just wrote about what scoundrels this guy Newton and his partner Leo Gabauer were. And if they were scoundrels, that means there's no such thing as flying saucers. You follow the logic?
Yes.
Yeah. And so here we go. From when the trial happened in 1953, based on Kahn's research, he set it up to try and get them charged. They were found guilty of fraud. The trial was a kangaroo court type of thing, and we talk about that to some degree in the book. And after that, Newton and Gabauer were never sent to jail. They never had to pay a fine. Newton had to pay court costs, and that was it. Mm-hmm. But from then on, the Aztec incident was considered to be a hoax.
Hmm. Wow. Now, you said that these oil workers and others had seen two alien bodies that looked to be deceased, for lack of a better term. Did these bodies end up somewhere else that you know of? Was it Wright-Patterson? And also, was it just two initially and then there were more, or was it only two of these beings that were found in the craft?
Okay, let's clarify that. The oil field workers saw two bodies slumped over a console in the upper level of the craft. But when it opened up and they got into it, they found all these other bodies. And a total of 14 to 16,
wow,
we can't be sure of the number, were lined up outside the craft and were taken away. Now, the saucer and the bodies ended up, the first stop was Los Alamos, which is the most secure facility in New Mexico. And after that, we were not sure where they went, except that we've got new sources since the book was published that definitely puts the saucer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 1950s. And I would say that in 1948 to 50, the only cryogenic facilities that may have been available were at Wright-Patterson, because that's where they did all the study of foreign technology. And remember, Area 51 was still just Groom Lake. It was still an atomic bomb test range, and it hadn't developed into the monster facility that it later became. I would say probably the bodies could have been distributed in more than one place. When you have 14 to 16 bodies, you have wealth to distribute.
Yes, absolutely. And so when we talk about this incident, was there any physical evidence either left behind on the land, or was anybody able to take anything outside of the government confiscation?
Okay. Remember that this craft landed softly on the mesa. It was undamaged, unlike Roswell, where you had a horrendous crash and the thing was ripped open and they had to scour the landscape for months, perhaps, trying to get every little scrap of alien material. That this one, the saucer was complete. So I don't think any alien material was left on the mesa. Mm-hmm. But let's remember that Roswell was botched. They put a story in the newspaper, had to cover up later, say it was a weather balloon. And so there were a lot of problems there. But by the time 8 months later, when Aztec happened, they had their act together. They were able to secure the site, debrief the few witnesses they had, get them out of there, and then take their time in a cordoned off area to make sure they got the saucer and the bodies off the mesa. And then they sanitized it. And the military does this even with plane crashes. They want the area left the way it was before the event. Mm-hmm. And they even planted some trees some scrub juniper to take the place of those who were knocked down by the disc. So this is where you have the skill of the United States Air Force in their first major recovery after Roswell.
One thing I haven't asked you yet, you said there were 14 bodies, so I take it they were all deceased, but then that begs the question, what did they die from? Is there any kind of thought that you have about that?
I think a lot of people have talked about this. Frank Scully said that they were described as being looked as though they'd been cooked or charred in some way. They were not green. They were not gray. They looked like they had been browned in some way. So if they were all dead when the thing landed, it was either decompression coming from outer space or possibly a penetration by some earthly weapon that caused the decompression, or it could have been radar. There was the strongest radar the United States had was mounted in northern New Mexico at that time. And anybody who knows anything about radar knows that it's really just microwave. It's microwave, and it was very strong. It wasn't controlled then. It's a lot better now. But this radar base of El Vado, it was called, the people there said that the radar was so strong, it cooked birds in the air. So there's always decompression, radar waves that the saucer may have not have been anticipating. And people say, well, if they could get from one planet to another, they certainly wouldn't have any accidents. And we know better than that. Stuff happens.
Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways, this story is bigger than Roswell, or I would say it at least rivals it. Why is Roswell, why did that receive so much traction? As you said, it started up in 1980, and why is this incident not, I guess, in the psyche of Americans like Roswell is?
Well, it's going to be, but let's face it, the reason for that is because on the first episode of the new X-Files, Agent Mulder himself said that Aztec was more important than Roswell. But all kidding aside, Roswell got traction because it was the first recovery case that was made public in a wide manner. Stanton Friedman, the dean of saucer researchers, found Jesse Marcel in Houma, Louisiana. And that was the first time that a witness had said, yeah, I was there. This is what happened. And the story started with Stanton Friedman. And when the Roswell incident hit the Berlitz book, It was a bombshell, because the first time I had ever read of something verifying the landing and recovery of aliens from a crash. But Aztec from 1953 on was considered to be a joke, a hoax, and that Scully had been duped into writing a book about something that didn't happen.
Now, when I think of the government taking over a UFO site, I imagine a bunch of soldiers marching around and them loading a UFO onto a large flatbed, covering it with some kind of a tarp, and then moving it out in the middle of the night. How is that typical? How did they move this? What was the procedure for moving this UFO?
We have clues in Scully. Even though this craft appeared to be completely seamless, a one-piece casting, if you like. When they got inside, they found that it was held together by pins and that it was modular. It came apart in three sections. So you'd have three 33-foot sections. And they were able to use the Dragon Wagon, the standard vehicle they used for moving tanks off the battlefield in World War II, and they could put each section sort of vertically on the Dragon Wagon, tie it down, and as you say, you put some kind of tarp over it, and take it through the night and down dirt roads and back ways to get to the gates of Los Alamos, where it would be safe and never seen by the public.
Mm-hmm. And What does the military generally do in New Mexico, and why do we see so much of UFO activity, it seems like, at least during that time, in New Mexico? Is there a tie-in?
Obvious tie-in. New Mexico had more military people than it had civilians in 1948. Remember, you had Los Alamos, where the atomic bomb was developed. You've got White Sands Proving Grounds, later White Sands Missile Range, where they were starting to test V-2 rockets that they brought over from Germany. You had Roswell Army Air Field that became Walker Air Force Base, and that was the only atomic bomb group in the world at that time. And you had, at the corner of New Mexico, you had Fort Bliss, and that's right at the corner of New Mexico and El Paso, and so on. You had radar, and you had Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. You had Sandia Laboratories. This is all government military research, and it would seem to me that the visitors were very interested in what was going on in New Mexico at that time.
Yeah, and maybe we should have been too.
Yeah.
Now, you have many documents in this book, The Aztec UFO Incident, so you've obviously done a lot of homework. And I read that you've actually collected, you and the Ramseys have actually collected over 55,000 documents pertaining to this incident. What type of documents are they, and what do they tell us about this?
Let us now salute Scott Ramsey, who, when he researches, he really researches. He has been to Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, where all the Air Force records are kept. He's been to archives at universities. For example, Frank Scully's archives are in the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And anything that had even tangentially was connected to Aztec and flying saucers, he grabbed it and he stuffed it in boxes. And we only have in the book maybe the tiniest tip of the iceberg of the supporting documents. But he felt that we needed to have everything we could get to verify what happened and also to verify what didn't happen. For example, people said, oh, yeah, it was really just an airplane that landed there. It was really a V-2 rocket that landed on Hart Canyon Mesa and so on. And you had to be able to disprove that to show that it was BS. And that the only thing that could have happened was this flying saucer that landed on the mesa. Either that, or nobody saw anything and nothing ever happened. It was a complete pipe dream. And we've proved that it happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, during your research, you were able to track down the scientists who worked on the craft. Can you tell us about them?
Okay. We have a whole chapter devoted to the 8 or 9 scientists that's Frank Scully called Dr. G, G-E-E. And he said that the Dr. G he was talking about was a composite of research scientists who were excellent in geomagnetics. Now, that's interesting because this flying saucer had no propellers, had no rockets, had no jets. How the heck did it fly? And today we understand that there's such a thing as magnetic field propulsion, even if we can't do it. And so these scientists, Scully never named. He went to his grave never naming any one of those scientists because the government wanted to know who they were. And I think that what Scott Ramsey did, he went to the government archives, he went to universities, and there's a short biography of 8 or 9 scientists in the book showing how they worked for the government during the war in geomagnetic research, and they were very likely to have been involved in the Aztec recovery. And some of them, Frank Scully says he had one of the Dr. G's in his house. They went on expeditions together, but he never named them. And he just said things like, Dr. G has more degrees than a thermometer. And we found people who had been to the universities he talked about and would likely be the guy. And they knew Silas Newton. And those connections put it together. For example, there was one of the scientists who had an office in Denver Ah, could he have been the scientist who was supposed to go on stage at the University of Denver that day? And Silas Newton was a friend of his. Silas Newton was on the stage talking to the Science 101 class. This is the kind of sleuthing that you have to do to make sure that you've got the right guys. And so I think since then, of course, we found another person that is not in the book that should be included here. And he was a paperclip scientist brought over from Germany. As you know, we brought a couple of thousand of Nazis over here, scientists and other people who we thought could help in the new Cold War. Mm-hmm. And this guy apparently went to Aztec before the saucer was moved. We didn't have that information until January. So I suppose we're going to have to write another book before we're done, right?
Yes, absolutely. Please do. And speaking of books, this book is The Aztec UFO Incident, The Case, Evidence, and Elaborate Cover-Up of One of the Most Perplexing Crashes in History. I know it's right up our listeners' alley. It's co-written with Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey, and we are speaking this week with Frank Thayer. Now, Frank, this is an interesting story. The Farmington Armada of March 1950. What was that about?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. I think somebody's going to try and do a book on that particular incident. But 2 years after the Aztec incident, and we had to do a chapter on it because it should have been famous. All of a sudden, in March 1950, the skies above Farmington, New Mexico, which is just a few miles from Aztec, by the way, were filled with flying saucers. Some people said there were dozens. Some people said there were hundreds. They were all dull aluminum color. They were chasing each other all over the skies. They were putting on a wonderful show. And one of them was bright red. He was the leader. And finally, they went to the south, southeast and went over Las Vegas, New Mexico, before they disappeared. But this is something that almost everybody in Farmington, New Mexico at the time went out of their houses to see. It was in broad daylight. And so we covered it as best we could because the Farmington Daily Times had it front page news on that day in history. Now, why that didn't become major news in the New York Times and so on, heaven only knows. But that particular thing, it happened before Scully's book came out, and it was, you can imagine what it must have looked like to have these craft flying over your town. Again, it was debunked. Mm-hmm. Now, a fellow named Andy Andrews was a state cop, and he was the only one quoted in newspapers other than Farmington. And he said that it was fluff from cottonwood trees that people were seeing. You believe that one?
No.
Okay. He was one of the cops on the Mesa in the morning of March 25th, 1948. Hmm. What is he doing saying this? Could it be the fix was in?
Yeah, absolutely.
We got him.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you some big picture topics or questions about this. And one of the things is, as I'm talking to you, it would be silly for me to ask you if you think this is terrestrial or extraterrestrial. But then that also begs the question, if this is extraterrestrial, what are these beings, would you say, the equivalent to in our society? Are these soldiers, scientists, explorers? How would you personally define them?
Oh, I've run the gamut on that. I know about as much about this as you do or your listeners do. And let me mention I lived in Canada for 11 years. Minister of Defense Paul Hellyer is a very important fellow. He has come out and he's made statements to the effect that these beings are real. They've been here for a long time, and there's far more than one or two species that are studying the Earth. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, who were these people? I've seen some descriptions saying that some of the people were just manufactured beings. They weren't really, they were like androids. Some say that they were from a system that had different pressure, different biology. I don't know.
Yeah.
But obviously, if they were soldiers from the Orson Welles era, they would have taken us over already. If they're scientists, what better place to observe than a planet that where everybody's just standing off and watching its development, whether we succeed or fail. And I think it's like you and I are goldfish in a bowl trying to figure out who's putting the food in the water and who are these giant creatures outside the goldfish bowl. And we can't make any judgment on that. It's like lab mice trying to understand the hypotheses of the experimenters.
Yeah. And I've often wondered if they were soldier types or even explorers. Let's say here in the United States, we sent two diplomats out to a foreign country, which has actually happened, and they've been killed. We would try to recover those bodies. So I'm often wondering that I've heard stories that aliens, there are alive aliens, at least at one time, that were under some type of incarceration here, and also bodies. So then that would beg the question, do you think they've ever tried to recover their own kind?
I wonder. I've heard some of those stories, and some of them are pretty credible. And I see no reason why we wouldn't have recovered live aliens. They say that at least one of them may have been live from Roswell. All the ones at Aztec were definitely dead from all the stories we have. And I would say that there's a lot more going on here than we are ever going to know because, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you would agree with this, the United States government will never reveal what they know.
Right.
And they just never will. I don't care how many decades go by, they will never reveal what they know about UFOs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you wonder, are these beings treated like prisoners, or are they then released and allowed to return to their own habitat?
That all depends, you know. And again, I know nothing about this. I'm just, this is blue sky stuff. That if, for example, there was a landing at Holloman Air Force Base, as some people have said, that's in New Mexico, by the way, by Alamogordo, and they had a conference or a meeting with of Air Force officers, if President Eisenhower met aliens back in 1954. I don't know this, but I would say that this would also be above top secret, and they may have had a compact with them. But in our book, we're satisfied just proving that this incident occurred, and nobody's going to be able to debunk it, no matter how hard they try.
Yeah. And speaking of your book, in your book, The Aztec UFO Incident, you have a timeline that shows some pretty major UFO events through the years. You've hit all of them. And you've researched this to a great extent. So what do you think this timeline of all these major UFO events reveals about the UFO phenomenon?
That was one of our most important decisions, to put this timetable in, to take the average person who may not have been fully engaged in this kind of research and say, where does it start? We have the Kenneth Arnold thing. We've got the Roswell crash. We've got the Project Sign. We've got Project Grudge. And in between there, you've got the landing at Aztec. Mm-hmm. We go on through showing how the hoax developed. We end up to the trial and all that. Then we go to the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And if someone gets the book and reads through this timeline, they will see that there's some logic to this, and there's definitely an order in how things have happened. I think, for example, there was the Condon Committee in the 1960s, and it was impaneled and paid for by the government at the University of Colorado specifically to debunk UFOs. Dr. Condon knew what the conclusion was going to be before the committee ever met. He said, I've just got to wait a year before I file my report. But one of the people on the Condon Committee, Professor Roy Craig, he went along with the Condon Committee. We wanted to debunk UFOs, but you know what? Before he died, he admitted to Scott Ramsey, he had been to the crash site several dozen times. Now, there's no Disneyland at the crash site. There must be a reason why he kept coming back to that mesa all by himself.
Fascinating.
So I think the timeline is gives people a very clear view of how flying saucers became part of national consciousness, how the governments tried to suppress it, and how it keeps coming back. Stanton Friedman, he said that, he reported that 55% of Americans believe that some UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft. In 1950, 33% of people believed they were real, 55% now, and you know what? The greater the education, the more likely people are to accept that some UFOs are extraterrestrial craft. Mm-hmm. It's coming along. The public's going to believe this long before the government ever reveals a thing.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting point, long before the government reveals a thing. But I often wonder if there are things being revealed. For instance, your book reads like an episode of The X-Files, and that's a good thing. This book is very fascinating. It's a page turner. You want to get through it and gather all the facts as soon as you can. But that does beg the question, if The X-Files, and maybe broader than that, the movies about UFOs and aliens, the television programs and shows like The X-Files, are they trying to send us a message, do you think? And if so, what is it?
Well, you know, one of the courses I taught for 25, 30 years, propaganda and public opinion. One of the devices of propaganda is disinformation. Disinformation is not spreading false stories, but rather creating uncertainty in the mass public. So part of that is giving good information from spurious sources. So you put it in Close Encounters of the Third Kind or ET, and it's kind of hokey, but it's fun. It's entertaining. But you don't end up saying that convinces me they're real. It just says, I wish they were real. And so you end up with the government planting information, and some of it's real and some of it's so silly that nobody would believe it. But if you go back to the early 1950s, we had a Harvard professor named Donald Menzel who wrote a couple of books on flying saucers all about how they were swamp gas, they were temperature inversion, they were balloons, they were all these things. And you look at it now and say, how could a man with an education spread such false stories? Mm-hmm. But that was his job, because theoretically, from what we've learned, he may have been a part of MJ-12. His job was to spread uncertainty and hopefully get people to stop talking about flying saucers. And it worked for the New York Times and the Associated Press. They never talk about this. And I'm a journalism professor, and I know Associated Press does not print UFO stories unless there is a earthly logical explanation that leaves people with a smile on their face.
Interesting. Now, your book, The Aztec UFO Incident, I want to ask you, because we've discussed this before on other programs, I don't know the timeline here, this may have been before that. In fact, I think it was, but there were no incidences of men in black during this time, were there?
I've read some about men in black, and it does seem an insidious thing, not just in the United States, but in Great Britain and some other places, in Brazil and so forth. And I think that the men in black do not seem to have been operating in Roswell. The witnesses said these were Air Force guys that came and told us that we'd be killed if we said anything. Mm-hmm. Aztec, we don't seem to see that. We saw the people on the Mesa being debriefed by the Army or Air Force, sent on their way, and none of them appear to have been harassed after that. So the men in black thing, and I suspect that unless you and I see something we shouldn't see, we're not going to be visited by government operatives. But I do think that there's something to that, that there are some people, very strange people, who come around and silence those who've seen what they're not supposed to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the book is The Aztec UFO Incident, the case, evidence, and elaborate cover-up of one of the most perplexing crashes in history, written by Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and, of course, Frank Thayer. And we're speaking with Frank Thayer. Now, Frank, before you go, sort of a big look at your book. What do you hope people take away from your book, The Aztec UFO Incident?
Okay, Bruce, the mission was to write the best flying saucer book ever written, well, number one, and number two, leave people with absolute certainty that I don't care what else you've read, that when you read this book, you will know that a craft landed on Hart Canyon Mesa in March 1948. It was from somewhere else, and there were 14 to 16 bodies taken out of there, and the United States government recovered this saucer, and they still have it. Once you accept this, then you have to look at the world with totally different lenses.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Again, The Aztec UFO Incident by Frank Thayer. Frank, this has been a lot of fun, and I hope when your next book comes out that we'll have you back and talk about that too, because, like I said, you're a great guest, but also this is a fascinating book. The Aztec UFO Incident, Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer. Frank, once again, thank you so much.
Oh, I loved it. FrankThayer.net for my website, TheAztecIncident.com for the project website. The book's on Amazon. It's easy to find. You get to us, and we'll send you a signed copy, too.
And it's published by New Page.
Right.
Frank, once again, thank you so much.
Ah, this is such fun. I enjoyed talking with you, Bruce. Good night.
Good night.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Thank you for listening to The Big Finale. I'm Bruce Collins. Join us here next time as time brings us closer to the big finale. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
I guess so. I'm just eating a cookie, and I'll be done in 2 seconds.
Oh, no problem. Is it is it chocolate chip?
Is there any other kind?
I interviewed Famous Amos one time, and I thought his favorite cookie would have been the chocolate chip, but he likes
it. He invented.
Yeah, he likes macadamia nut. Who knew?